After the American Revolutionary War, the United States aimed to expand westward beyond the Appalachian Mountains and on to the Mississippi River. However, the vast 828,000 square mile area known as the Louisiana Territory was already claimed by France. It became a particular point of tension for Americans as Napoleon Bonaparte and France considered their own expansion, and fears about losing access to the Mississippi River settled in. President Thomas Jefferson, who preferred diplomacy over his opponent's call for war, sent representatives to France to negotiate a deal to purchase New Orleans and West Florida for up to $10 million. They were stunned when France pivoted on their expansion plans and offered the entire Louisiana Territory for $15 million. This massive acquisition immediately doubled the size of the U.S., catalyzing significant growth. From 1800 to 1850, the population surged from 5 million to over 23 million people, driven by high birth rates and immigration. After the Civil War, the government passed several land acts to fuel expansion efforts. The Homestead Act of 1862 provided each settler with 160 acres of public land. For comparison, the median lot size of a new single-family detached home sold in 2016 was just under one-fifth of an acre. The Kincaid Act of 1904 was an amendment to make public land within 37 counties in northwest Nebraska completely free, aside from a modest filing fee. By the early 1900s, much of the prime land along rivers had been claimed, so the Enlarged Homestead Act of 1909 increased the number of acres for a homestead to 320 acres for less fertile land. Unfortunately, inexperienced farming practices, wartime pressures, and a misunderstanding of the ecology led to overcultivation of farmlands. A severe drought hit the Midwest and Southern Great Plains in 1930. In an interview with Lakeland PBS, Lowell Castor described the living conditions of his childhood during what he refers to as the Dirty 30s.
The ground was so dry that when it sprinkled just a little bit, drops of water would stand on top of the dust. They wouldn't soak in because it was too dry to soak in. Just like you'd put a drop of water in a cup of foul flour, it just stands right up straight.
Crops failed, exposing the bare, overplowed farmland. Dry, eroding soil began to blow away, leading to massive dust storms and economic devastation, especially in the southern plains. The environmental disaster was known as the Dust Bowl. Massive dust clouds, some stretching 2,000 miles, caused widespread damage and health crises, including dust pneumonia, which killed hundreds to thousands of people.
But there was no house good enough to keep the dirt out of the house. The dirt is fine. It's just as fine as air. And we had stuff, wet rags around the windows and doors and stuff to keep the dirt out, but you can't keep it out because it's just as fine as air. Oh no, the house looked clean. But then it would be that way again in 15, 20 minutes.
The impact on living creatures was unbelievable.
My brother and I, and the hired man, we had what we called the seven-year itch. We just scratched all the time. You know, we did. We had it for about 5-6 years. And then when we moved to Minnesota, it was a different climate. We had green grass, and we had rain. And we got over that itch. My dad always coughed a lot. And he went to the doctor when he was 60 years old or so, and the doctor x-rayed him. A couple days later, he called us up on the phone and says, come in here, we want to take some more pictures. And about one-third of his lungs, it would be just as hard as stone. Because, and of course, that's the reason he coughed, because he couldn't get enough air to breathe. And of course, that's what really got him in the end, because he inhaled so much of that dirt. It was the same way with the cattle. They would have 5 gallons of mud in the bottom of their stomachs. And that weight of that mud, it wouldn't digest.
On Mark Albertson's YouTube channel, Time Capsule, he interviewed another Dust Bowl witness, Wanda, who shared the dire straits that her family experienced and what they did to survive.
Not only did the animals not have any kind of decent fodder, but we had no water. And in ranch land, the wells are situated out by themselves. There was a well on a neighboring ranch not too far from us. So my mother and my brothers, they would get up at various times during the night and drive our cattle up there to water. One morning, about 2 o'clock in the morning, the rancher was there with his shotgun. He said, "Hold it, boys." My mother said, "Stand back, boys. Jim would kill a kid, but he wouldn't dare shoot a woman." She drove the cattle through. There was a lot of discussion, of course. What are we going to do? My mother said, "The next time we take them to water, we'll go in the daytime. We'll keep cutting the fence and going through." And my mother always regretted saying to that guy, "You have degraded yourself by circumstances to the point that you would actually kill a neighbor over a tank of water." And the next day, this guy killed himself. And of course, you know, all of us were in the same circumstance, but that always stood out in my mind that sometime, and my mother pointed out, what we're doing is wrong. You know, we have no right to go over there. All we could hope to do when times get better is to pay back what we've taken.
The worst event occurred on April 14, 1935, when a cold front from Canada clashed with warm air over the Dakotas. Winds whipped into a frenzy as billowing clouds of dust grew hundreds of miles wide and thousands of feet high as it headed south. The monstrous dust storm blacked out the sun, forcing citizens to scramble for shelter, creating chaos and near-apocalyptic conditions. Folk singer Woody Guthrie recalled that, quote, "You couldn't see your hand before your face," end quote.
Anyway, like I told you, the old dust storm hit there. These people all congregated in their little houses. And in the room in the house that I was in.
The event even inspired this song titled "So Long, It's Been Good to Know You."
Telling each other, "So long, it's been good to know you. Dusty old dust is blowing me home, and I ain't got long to stay. I've got to be drifting along. Well, here's what happened."
The storm pounded communities for hours. In a panic, one woman reportedly contemplated killing her baby to save it from what she thought was Armageddon. It's unclear whether anyone died in the event, but one man reportedly went blind. Others couldn't stop coughing, and animals that managed to survive fled for their lives. It is estimated that at least 3,000 tons of topsoil was displaced in this event known as Black Sunday. I'm Demetrius Lynch, and this is Going Green.
At this juncture in my career, I was told explicitly that a line needed to be drawn between what part of my work constituted basic research and what part was not basic research because it was routine monitoring.
Now with modern materials and technology, we can apply to houses the same efficiency of engineering that we apply to suspension bridges and airplanes.
In episode 1, we explored the transformative impact of Thomas Newcomen's steam engine and its pivotal role in the Industrial Revolution and advancing European industries. We covered the environmental implications of carbon dioxide, highlighted historical scientific contributions to our understanding of the greenhouse effect, and emphasized the need for balance between industrial progress and environmental conservation. If you haven't listened to that episode, I encourage you to go back and listen to all the episodes of this series in order. After the Dust Bowl and Black Sunday, hard lessons about the environment and ecological mismanagement were learned. But in the wake of catastrophe and destruction, there is always room for innovation and recovery. Through ingenuity and careful study, we can find ways to harmonize our technological advancements with the natural world. And there are well-known but unexpected individuals that would answer the call. And I'll share more about them after the break. Episode 2, Doing More with Less. When thinking about balance with nature, indigenous communities may be one of the first to come to mind. These communities have a historical continuity with the given region prior to colonization or annexation, having a deep understanding of surrounding natural resources and ecosystems. While different indigenous and local groups have different cultures and practices, they tend to share a holistic and human-inclusive view of nature that's imbued with cultural or spiritual value. In this view, in part, that forms the basis for indigenous land management, which often includes protecting sacred lakes or forests, or creating rules against exploiting certain species. Their livelihoods are often also nature dependent, so climate change is significant as it impacts multiple parts of their socioeconomic system, as they are often the first to feel the brunt of its effects. You may be surprised to hear that at least a quarter of the world's land area is owned, managed, used, or occupied by indigenous people. The silver lining is that, according to reports, ecological degradation happens at a slower rate in these areas. That's not to say that indigenous people don't alter habitats, but in general, the concept of conservation appears to be more embedded in indigenous traditions compared to industrialized cultures. Incorporating that approach, there are practical ways to ensure the balance of the environment in which we live so it may continue to provide services such as water, fertile soil, food, shelter, and medicines. In the early 20th century, similar methods were championed and disseminated by a historical figure that also may surprise you, George Washington Carver, who you likely associate with peanuts.
At Tuskegee, we've developed more than 200 products from peanuts. We've made everything from axle grease to synthetic rubber, and we're finding out new uses for the peanut constantly.
What are you working on now, Dr. Carver?
The finest use we've been able to make of peanuts is in the treatment of the after effects of infantile paralysis. That's what I'm working on now. Massages with peanut oils has worked miracles in some cases. There is a lot of work to be done, but I feel we're on the trail of something really important.
Born enslaved in western rural Missouri, Carver was orphaned as an infant and freed shortly after the Civil War. Throughout his childhood and young adulthood, he obtained a spotty education and was largely self-taught. In his 20s, he moved to Iowa, where he enrolled at Simpson College in central Iowa to study art. One of his teachers saw a different path for him and encouraged Carver to study botany at Iowa State Agricultural College, now Iowa State University. Carver was immersed in the study of soils, entomology, analytical and agricultural chemistry, practical agriculture, landscape gardening, and rural architecture. After graduating in 1896 with a bachelor's in agriculture and a master's in science, Carver accepted a teaching position at Tuskegee University, formerly known as the Tuskegee Institute, a private, historically black university in Tuskegee, Alabama. As he rode the train to Alabama, his heart sank. He recalled, quote,
"My train left the golden wheat fields, and the tall green corn of Iowa for the acres of cotton, nothing but cotton. The scraggly cotton grew close up to the cabin doors. A few lonesome collards, the only sign of vegetables. Stunted cattle, bony mules. Fields and hillsides cracked and scarred with gullies and deep ruts. Not much evidence of scientific farming anywhere. Everything looked hungry. The land, the cotton, the cattle, and the people.
End quote. Carver was particularly struck by the precarious existence that black farmers lived under Jim Crow laws, which enforced racial segregation and inequality since the 1870s. In the Confederate States of America, and in some others, despite the legal principle of separate but equal, facilities and opportunities for African Americans were consistently subpar. Sharecroppers, mostly poor blacks, farmed land they didn't own. So, without assets, one bad harvest could plunge them into catastrophic debt. There was no incentive to improve the soil, as they could be evicted at any time. Jim Crow laws institutionalized economic, educational, and social disparities, relegating African Americans to second-class citizenship. Carver recognized the urgent need for sustainable agriculture to uplift these marginalized communities. Carver, like indigenous communities, had a way of thinking holistically about the environment and an understanding of the interconnectedness between the health of the land and the health of the people who lived on it. Cotton, though profitable, exhausted the soil with its shallow roots and monocultural practices. He encouraged farmers to diversify, going as far as to travel to rural farmers with agricultural equipment and materials to demonstrate how to make a living on the soil under the circumstances and inequities of Jim Crow laws. Carver encouraged farmers to look to the land for what they needed. Grow, or at the very least forage, their own vegetables and proteins to save money on food. Compost instead of buying fertilizer. Instead of buying paint, make it from clay and soybeans. Peanuts, an enormously rich food source, could be grown in the same fields as cotton due to differing production times. Furthermore, while some plants need fertilization with nitrogen, peanuts produce their own, restoring nutrients to depleted soil. Carver encouraged black farmers to grow peanuts. He distributed a white paper that outlined various ways to consume peanuts and how to maximize crop profits. Carver's practical strategies for sustainable farming and advocacy for understanding soil emerged in a time to address two ecological and economic disasters. First, in the early 1920s, the boll weevil beetle migrated to the United States from central Mexico, infesting all the cotton growing areas in the country, devastating the industry and those working in the American South. The second was the Dust Bowl. After witnessing the environmental and economic disasters of the Dust Bowl, President Franklin Roosevelt sought Carver's advice on agricultural methods and began implementing different policies to provide aid. FDR established different administrative groups to aid farmers' resettlement, emergency relief, soil conservation, tree planting, and more. Over time, three American presidents, Theodore Roosevelt, Calvin Coolidge, and Franklin Roosevelt, as well as the Crown Prince of Sweden, Mahatma Gandhi, Henry Ford, and Thomas Edison, all sought Carver's advice on agricultural methods. Towards the end of the 30s, the world continued to receive confirmation about climate change. In 1938, there was another groundbreaking but wrongly dismissed warning about the rise of global temperatures and CO2 concentrations. The calendar effect, as it was known, was pioneered by Guy Callender, a British steam engineer. Once overshadowed by more prominent scientists, he has increasingly become recognized for his contributions to climate science. Born in 1898, Callender was the son of Britain's leading steam engineer. Driven by pure curiosity, Guy began researching the atmosphere in the early 1930s. He was intrigued by the rapid changes that humans were making to the atmosphere's composition. Without any formal training in atmospheric sciences, Callender embarked on a massive project to collect and analyze data on gas properties, atmospheric structure, sunlight variations, fossil fuel usage, ocean currents, and historical data from 147 weather stations worldwide. His efforts laid the groundwork for the modern climate models. In 1938, he proposed that human activities, specifically the emission of carbon dioxide, were warming the planet. This hypothesis, presented at the Royal Meteorological Society, was met with skepticism from established climate scientists who dismissed the impact of carbon dioxide based on its minute concentration in the atmosphere. Despite professional dismissals and scientific consensus against him, Callender persisted. His findings showed that even trace amounts of carbon dioxide could significantly affect global temperatures. The climate science community slowly began to acknowledge the potential significance of his findings. Remarkably, Guy actually didn't have concerns about increasing CO2 levels and global warming, within reason. To the contrary, he argued that small increases in mean temperature could have beneficial aspects, such as improving agriculture in colder regions and indefinitely postponing the return of the Ice Age. In 1955, U.S. researcher Gilbert Plass utilized early computers to analyze the infrared absorption of gases, revealing that doubling CO2 concentrations could raise global temperatures by 3 to 4 degrees Celsius. By this time, numerous records were showing how we humans were altering the planet, with potential significant consequences for the global climate. But the first and now iconic examples of documenting global climate change were the precise measurements of the concentration of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere made at the mountain station on Mauna Loa, Hawaii, by Charles David Keeling. Keeling's meticulous documentation of atmospheric carbon dioxide levels has been pivotal in highlighting the impact of human activities on global climate change. Born in Pennsylvania in 1928, Keeling pursued his studies in chemistry and isotope geochemistry, eventually earning his PhD. His career took a significant turn in 1953 when he joined the California Institute of Technology, where he developed an interest in atmospheric CO2 levels. Previously, the concept that human activities could alter atmospheric CO2 on a global scale was mostly theoretical. Early theorists posited that CO2 levels might affect global temperatures, but widespread concern was minimal due to the belief that oceans absorbed most CO2 increases. This changed in the 1950s when Roger Revel and Hans Suess of the Scripps Institution of Oceanography identified the ocean's limited capacity to absorb CO2 due to slow mixing with deeper waters. Recognizing the importance of accurate CO2 measurement, Keeling adopted an infrared analyzer for his studies, establishing rigorous calibration standards to ensure consistent and comparable results across different environments and over time. His efforts included setting up measurement stations in remote locations like Mauna Loa, Hawaii, and Antarctica to avoid local CO2 distortions and capture background atmospheric changes. By 1959, Keeling had already published seminal findings demonstrating an increase in atmospheric CO2 at the South Pole, which corresponded with fossil fuel emission estimates and ocean uptake. His observations at Mauna Loa also revealed a seasonal fluctuation in CO2 levels, influenced by the vegetative cycles in the Northern Hemisphere.
When I began to measure atmospheric carbon dioxide and carbon in ocean water just 50 years ago this year, my work was praised for showing more precisely than earlier studies how carbon was distributed in nature. When I persisted in making measurements of the same kind because I found the results interesting as pure knowledge, I was supported by program managers of science up to a point.
That was Charles David Keeling, speaking about his career during an acceptance speech for the 2005 Tyler Prize Award. Despite facing numerous funding challenges, he maintained continuous records which now span several decades, showing a rise in CO2 levels. These records not only confirm the increase in atmospheric CO2, but also illustrate enhanced vegetation, quote, breathing, in the Northern Hemisphere and fluctuations related to climate events like El Nino. Further advancing the field, Keeling utilized this data during a sabbatical in Stockholm in the early 1960s, collaborating with meteorologist Bert Bolin to perform the first inversion analysis of atmospheric CO2.
At this juncture in my career, I was told explicitly that a line needed to be drawn between what part of my work constituted basic research and what part was not basic research because it was routine monitoring. The repetitive measurements of my program, even while I was attempting to improve them, I was told, should be relinquished to a government agency assigned responsibility for such measurements and even for where they should be made. I wasn't forbidden to go on with routine measurements, but I no longer qualified for help from government of the kind urged by Vannevar Bush. Since these measurements and the choices of where to make them were the heart of my program, I didn't accept the argument. And with to some degree of struggle, I won a series of temporary reprieves from government, which allowed my program to survive.
Keeling's groundbreaking work demonstrated that fossil fuel emissions significantly influence global CO2 distribution, a finding refined over time as more atmospheric monitoring stations emerged. During this time of scientific discovery, the built world and the philosophy around it was radically changing in response. The geodesic dome emerged on the world stage as the Ford Motor Company contracted the installation of a 93-foot plastic and aluminum shell over the Rotunda Building in Dearborn, Michigan in 1952. It was Richard Buckminster Fuller's first commercial contract for the dome, a spherical structure composed of triangular elements that formed a network of circles, or geodesics, on the surface of a given sphere. The dome, patented by Fuller in 1947, addressed two crises he identified before they entered the popular consciousness: climate change and unaffordable housing.
I saw that if we really turned it on what I call livingry,
yes.
I needed a term like weaponry,
yes.
Livingry, then what you mean environment controls, shells, the apparatus inside to clean us and prepare food,
life
and conserve, and handle the energies. Mm-hmm.
This is Fuller in a 1974 interview on Conversations with Harold Hudson Channer, discussing the benefits of the geodesic dome design for housing.
I then went into that, and that brought about the discovery of the geodesic dome and so forth. There are now over 100,000 around the world.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And I now really know that I can give you, for instance, 30 buildings for one, for a given snow load, hurricane loading, earthquake loading, for a given clear span. I can give you 30 buildings for one against an inordinate known engineering strategy than spherical and triangulated tensegrity structures.
Yes.
So that I now know by actual measurement of what technology you do need to make man a success.
Mm-hmm.
I now know it's highly feasible. We have the resources, we have the knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
The metals have not been lost of in mind. They simply come out and get metal melted out to take one Cadillac, melt it up and get out two Japanese cars, twice as good.
Yes. Uh-huh.
So that what we keep circulating, I now know with the resources we already mined, the knowledge we already have, is highly feasible to take care of all of humanity
mm-hmm.
at a higher standard living than anybody's ever known.
Yeah.
And it can be done by 1985.
Uh-huh.
In fact, in this very room we're in here today, we're just going over the last World Game workshop, which has been going on for the last month, and the team really did undertake to absolutely certify all those figures I just gave you.
Yes, uh-huh.
And we now know actually the critical path of how we phase out the fossil fuels burning, how we phase out the nuclear, how we do bring in the wind power, how we do bring in the hydrogen powers and so forth,
and
it actually can be done by 1985. I knew that because I made the
measure. To be clear, Fuller didn't invent the geodesic dome. That honor goes to Walter Bauersfeld, a German engineer who introduced a globe-shaped planetarium in 1926. But it was Fuller who arguably perfected the design in the late 1940s. With help from his students and friends, Fuller improved the dome's strength by drawing inspiration from structures that he found in nature, like those of snowflakes and crystals. He saw that the form's mutually reinforcing geometry held promise for homes and other buildings because of the remarkable strength-to-weight ratio, which means, among other things, that it can be constructed with comparative speed and cost-effectively. The geodesic dome became a symbol of technological optimism. While it was the discovery that brought him fame and wealth, Buckminster Fuller was a thinker and inventor that had a profound impact on architecture and how to approach design. His design philosophy of, quote, doing more with less, was a phrase he later coined to reflect the accelerating global trend towards the development of more efficient technology. Fuller was born into a family of New England nonconformists and was a descendant of Margaret Fuller, a prominent figure in the Transcendentalist movement. Despite being expelled twice from Harvard and never completing his formal education, Buckminster Fuller made significant contributions to modern design and architecture. He entered the construction field with his father-in-law and developed a novel building block method. However, the company faced financial difficulties, and by 1927, Fuller was out of work. Struggling with personal issues, including the death of his daughter and heavy drinking, this period of crisis led to a profound personal transformation. Standing by Lake Michigan, he decided against suicide, resolving instead to dedicate his life to understanding universal principles and applying them for the betterment of humanity. In the late 1920s, Fuller invented the Dymaxion House, an innovative factory-assembled home that was air-deliverable and equipped with its own utilities. The home was a revolutionary design aimed at redefining modern living. Round in plan, the design drew inspiration from grain silos, combining efficiency with cutting-edge technology.
Well, Mr. Fuller, why a round house?
Why not? The only reason houses have been rectangular all these years is that that is all it could do with the materials we had. Now, with modern materials and technology, we can apply to houses the same efficiency of engineering that we apply to suspension bridges and airplanes. A ventilator on top can induce a complete air change every 6 minutes. Air conditioning and heating cost only a quarter as much as in an ordinary house. Here is the living room.
The building was designed around a central mast anchored firmly into the ground. The structure's roof and floor hung from this core via steel cables, creating a floating effect while additional cables secured it to the ground. This unique house featured two bedrooms, two bathrooms, and a living area that included a dining room, kitchen, and additional storage with specially designed revolving shelves. An adjustable cap at the top of the house allowed for temperature control. Raising it invited cooling breezes, while lowering it helped insulate and warm the interior. Remarkably lightweight and transportable, the Dymaxion House weighed only 3,000 pounds, cost about as much as a car today, around $40,000, and could be disassembled and packed into a large tube, ready to be moved and reassembled as needed. Originally designed for deployment to locations as diverse as the Persian Gulf and North America's Great Plains, the Dymaxion House was a bold step towards autonomous, sustainable architecture. Fuller didn't impress everyone, however. Famous architect Philip Johnson, who was immune to Fuller's charisma, once complained, quote,
"Bucky Fuller was no architect, and he kept pretending he was,"
end quote. Still, Fuller did acquire an active following of architects. He taught in architecture schools, his work was published in architecture magazines, and he was close to Charles Eames and Frank Lloyd Wright. But it was Frank Lloyd Wright who slyly corrected Fuller, stating, quote,
"I am an architect interested in science. Buckminster Fuller is a scientist interested in architecture,"
end quote. Nevertheless, Fuller continued to innovate, focusing on designs that maximized resources and promoted sustainability. Throughout the 1960s and 70s, he became a cultural icon in the New Age movement, symbolizing the potential for technology to lead humanity to a sustainable future. He popularized the term Spaceship Earth, emphasizing that Earth's resources are finite and must be managed wisely. Fuller's philosophy extended beyond architecture into comprehensive thinking about the world's energy resources and industrial capabilities. His belief in doing more with less has become increasingly relevant in today's discussions on sustainability and environmental stewardship. His work continues to inspire architects, designers, and environmentalists aiming for a balance between human needs and ecological responsibility. Fuller's legacy is that of a visionary who saw the potential for design to solve complex global issues, urging humanity to think comprehensively about the future. The profound impact of the Louisiana Purchase and the lessons learned from the Dust Bowl underscore the delicate balance between human ambition and environmental limits. With figures like George Washington Carver and Richard Buckminster Fuller, we are reminded that we can harmonize our advancements with nature's systems. On the shoulders of climate scientists such as Guy Callender and Charles David Keeling, a growing stream of data, scientific studies, and eventually media begins to raise public awareness about climate change. The leap in awareness will spark outrage in the 1960s, culminating in regulatory reforms and heightened public awareness that ignite the modern environmental movement. Next time on Going Green.
Our goal is a decent environment in its broadest and deepest sense. And winning the environmental war is a whole lot tougher battle, challenge by far, than any other challenge ever to confront mankind.
Thanks for listening. Going Green is a Spaces podcast story brought to you by Lines. If you learned something from this episode or think it would resonate with a friend, please share it and rate and review the podcast on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. It really helps others find the show. If you have a question, want to submit a correction, or just share whatever is on your mind, I'd love to hear from you. You can do that at lines.studio/podcasts. That's lynes.studio/podcasts. And listen in to my wrap-up episode to hear my response. If you're looking for similar content, Spaces is a proud member of Gable Media, a digital media platform where you can find even more content like this. Visit gablemedia.com, that's gablemedia.com. And before I go, if you want to see additional photos, videos, clips, and other content that I found during my research, you can visit lines.studio/podcasts. Talk soon.